In this episode, we continue to explore the Russian north, and no place embodies the atmosphere of this region more than Vologda, with its unique and beautifully preserved wooden houses, mansions, and churches. Мартиновские ребята, молодежь перевезите, ко девок за реку. Перевезите, ко нас не утопите, ой, вот у сторону к мирному крыльцу. Tatiana, Vologda and the Russian north as a whole is famous for its wooden houses like these, and I can see, because they're absolutely everywhere. So say that I was a resident in Vologda back in the 19th century, how would I go about building a house like this? Would I do it myself? Would I hire an architect?
You'd start by choosing a suitable spot, depending on your occupation or other preferences. Then you'd probably hire a team of carpenters who'd help you put up the house. Traditionally, wooden homes were built by the whole family. A large crowd would gather and help assemble the hut, while the master of the house would provide food and drink.
So this greenhouse here, it's quite big. It's near the center of the city. Who did it belong to?
This building belonged to a peasant with the surname Naumov, and it was used as a tenement house, which means he built it for the purpose of renting out rooms. It's now known as the lacemaker's house. Why do you think that is?
Because the person made lace back in the day.
The owner rented out rooms to lacemakers who would come from all over the region. There was a market at the square down the street where they sold their products. Everyone knew this building was here and that you could always get a room. So it was a peasant's house.
Amazing.
One would think a peasant would have a smaller, more humble house, but that didn't apply to Vologda somehow.
And how long would it take a house like that one or this one to build?
Construction would start in the fall. A new house had to weather a winter first, because wood is very flexible and needs time to settle. After assembly, the logs needed time too. So the house would be finished later to make it move-in ready.
So you had to be very patient before you could move into one of these.
So you had to be patient, indeed, if you want to build a house like this.
Now, I heard there was a tradition that when you were building the house, you'd place a coin in each corner. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. For some reason, carpenters and stove makers were thought to be on friendly terms with the devil. People thought carpenters were very skilled and wizards with their axes. If the master of the house underpaid them, for example, they could play a mean trick on them, like making the wind always howl in the chimney as if an evil spirit lived there. All those beliefs revolved around the idea that your house is your fortress, and so it had to be protected. So those coins would be placed in each corner. Two such coins have recently been discovered in Vologda.
Really?
They disassembled a house for restoration and found these two coins. One was minted in 1855 and the other in 1853, if I'm not mistaken.
Brilliant. So real artifacts.
That discovery confirmed the custom existed.
Now, obviously, the Russian north and Vologda is famous for its bitterly cold winters. How insulated were these houses? Did they protect the inhabitants well from the winter?
These houses are very warm, of course. Different techniques were used to achieve this. Like this house here, it has wooden planks around the outside. That created a thermos effect, which helped keep the interior warm. Also, all the houses had brick stoves, which traditionally would be lit in the morning and evening. There would be up to 10 stoves per large house. Can you imagine?
10?
Yes.
How did you even keep them warm? How did you provide enough wood for them?
Just like that, every stove, one by one. That's why you're always comfortable in a wooden house, even if it's heated with modern radiators.
Tatiana, how old is this wooden house here?
This house was built around the early 1900s. Actually, in the year 1900, I believe. What sets Vologda's wooden architecture apart is that we have a variety of styles. Some houses display classical elements like columns, etc., while later structures would be designed in the Art Nouveau style, with characteristic windows. Some were built in the Russian style.
Now, we've already mentioned Vologda lace. It's one of Russia's most famous folk crafts. So, we've come to one of the country's oldest workshops to find out more. It's called Snezhinka, or Snowflake, because of the delicacy and uniqueness of each design.
Alyesia, I've heard that craftswomen have to think like an engineer when they're weaving Vologda lace. Is that true?
That is true. The initial design, the technical drawing, is prepared by an artist who creates the layout and thinks everything through. We're given a detailed plan to work with.
And what's the main elements of these designs, and is there any symbolism behind them?
You might think that because there are thousands of designs, there must be just as many elements. However, there are only four. The simplest one is called pletyeshok and looks like a braid. The second, polotnyanka, is visually denser and is the most characteristic feature of our lace. The third one is setka, or the mesh, and it looks just like a mesh. And the most complex element is called nasnovka, which looks like little leaves. Combinations of these four elements make up the whole lace.
And the Vologda lace, it's handmade. And what are these sort of elongated wooden spools that you use to make it?
Holding the threads with your fingers would be inconvenient. That's why they came up with these bobbins that we call koklyushki due to the noise they make. And we've been using the same type of bobbins for 200 years now. They make our work easier and help weave tighter lace.
Can I give it a go?
Sure.
Okay.
Take the bobbins.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have two basic moves which allow us to make all four of the elements. Move number one. The green one crosses over in your right hand, while the blue one crosses over in your left hand. Now the central ones. The central one on the right goes under the central one on the left. Good, yes. And don't forget to pull on the threads. How much tension determines the quality of the finished product.
Okay. Well, yeah. Almost there, almost.
And now just repeat.
Alyesia, do you ever see a point where this could be automated, or would it cease to be Vologda lace in that case?
We have two types of lace. What we're doing now is called pair and join lace, because you hold the bobbins in pairs and you join the lace at the edges. This lace can only be made by hand because joining has to be done with a crochet hook. There's another type of lace work where lace come out as long strips with the repeating patterns. This one can be made either by hand or on machine. Again, we're talking about old machines.
And what gives Vologda lace such sort of delicacy and lightness?
That's an interesting question. Basically, lace consists of holes. It's the holes, really, that make it so delicate and distinct in appearance. Technically speaking, it's not solid cloth. It's a weave. That's why it is what it is.
And how long, for example, would a piece like this take to make?
It's traditionally thought a lace maker could make lace the size of a woman's hand in a single day, or a square 8 by 8 centimeters. I've been working on this color for 80 hours. The smaller the piece, the more complicated it is, and the longer it takes. Tablecloths are easier to make.
And I've heard that children were taught from a very young age to weave Vologda lace. From what age do people start learning it these days?
It's true that girls used to start learning lace making at the age of 6 when they began weaving their own dowry. That's a fact. Today, some schools offer extracurricular lace making classes, so you can still start young, but most people are introduced to lace making after they finish school and enroll in an apprenticeship program. I personally have been making lace since I was 6, so I can confirm that it's possible.
Really? Even now?
Yes.
And I see you must have around a dozen threads here, Alyesia. What's the maximum number of threads you can use to make a piece of Vologda lace?
With this kind of lace, you can have probably up to 20 bobbins, which is typical. When making another kind of lace with long strips, a lace maker may have up to 300 pairs or 600 bobbins on the pillow.
And how do you keep track of them?
We're not assigned to a large project to start with. We get familiar with the elements one by one. By the time you get to work on something big, you have pretty much figured things out.
Do you find it meditative?
As we always say, it depends on your state of mind when you sit down to weave. If you were all worked up to begin with, it probably won't calm you down. But the monotonous nature of this process does have a soothing effect. You keep making the same moves.
I don't have a career just yet in making Vologda de lace.
You should just give it a little more effort. I can see your bobbins are positioned correctly.
Really? Well, I think you're being very kind, Alyesha.
Thank you.
Is it difficult to restore and maintain these houses these days?
Some houses only take a year or two to restore. And there's only moderate damage, while others take years to restore. As for maintenance, I often talk to the owners and they believe the houses are like living beings. The house is alive as long as there's someone living in it.
Well, I've also heard that it's not only people that live in these houses. There's also the house spirit, or the domovoy, and you have to stay on his good side and not offend him. How would you do that, and what do people back then believe in?
It's true. There's this belief that the main dweller of any home is its house spirit, who watches over everything. People have always tried to avoid upsetting these house spirits, to stay on their good side. You can leave your house spirit a saucer of milk as a treat. It's supposed to make them happy.
And do you do that now, Tatiana?
No, I just try to keep my apartment clean and I'm fine. Some mysterious things have happened. One owner committed suicide. He loved his house very much, though. People believe that when current residents don't take good care, houses get flooded or something else bad happens. These incidents have occurred.
Really? Wow, okay. That's the first time I've heard about a haunted wooden house.
This is one of Vologda's oldest houses. It was built in the 1780s.
Amazing. I noticed, Tatiana, that a lot of these buildings have really intricately designed window frames. What are the main elements of these frames, and is there any symbolism behind them?
Back then, these window castings didn't just cover the gap between the frame and the wall, which was the main purpose, but also served a protective function. All these symbols had a specific meaning. The top part of the casing represents the upper world. So the circle probably symbolizes the sun. The vertical parts represent earthly life. They frame the window, which looks onto what's happening right now. As for the bottom part, unfortunately, there's no bottom part here. The architect probably broke from tradition, and the casings were made to suit more modern trends. But if there were a bottom part, it would have been dedicated to the underworld, inhabited by spirits. It would have likely had a moon symbol, something like that. Let's go in.
I'd love to. Let's do it.
Without constant maintenance and attention, these beautiful houses wouldn't still be standing. So let's meet the people who lovingly restore and preserve Vologda's unique wooden architecture.
Vladimir, is it hard to stay motivated when you're restoring a building like this? I can see you've already made some progress, but I hope you won't mind me saying that there's still a lot of work to do here.
It's true, there's still a lot of work to do. We've spent 4 years already restoring this house because it's a very complex task. We're in the final stages now where we're restoring the interior.
And what's the most unusual artifact that you found when restoring a building like this?
Every house is unique in terms of what you can find. We've had an extraordinary amount of discoveries in this one. For example, we found this prosthetic leg under the siding.
It's a bit gruesome.
It was quite a surprise for us. Can you imagine? You remove the siding and a leg pops out from underneath.
Yeah.
We were very surprised. What are we going to find next?
Yeah.
We later found a second leg, did some research, and figured out they were most likely made pre-revolution. The chances are the designer lived here in Vologda.
Amazing. I've noticed as well that a lot of these houses are painted in really bright colors. Why is that? Is it to beat the winter blues?
Our experts removed the paint from the facade layer by layer and discovered the original color. We always try, with this house or the others, to restore them to their original look.
So it's authentic.
Yes, yes. Those colors were very interesting, actually. They were all bright and rich. These days we can pick from tens of thousands of shades, but back then they used natural pigments and the choice was rather narrow.
Vladimir, thank you very much. I'll let you put the leg down now. Apologies.
I can put it down, yes.
The formidable Russian troika derives its name from the number of horses that pull it, troika meaning three. Its amazing speed and beauty are quite unlike anything else in the world, and we got the chance to experience it for ourselves.
Alexei, so this is the famous Russian troika. We've only got one horse here at the moment, but you'll have another one on either side. Is it an advantage to having the horses next to each other rather than in a line?
This is the Russian troika. This harness combination is unique because you have horses running with different gaits in the same team. The horse in the middle trots, while the horses on both sides can canter or gallop. That's why you have different gaits, and they're harnessed abreast, straight across each other. Then the middle horse sets the direction, while the other two help it pull. There are sports troikas for competitions. Others are just used to carry passengers. Back in the day, troikas helped with travel on poor roads and over the vast distances in Russia. That was their purpose.
And is this a specific breed of horse, or does it depend more on their size, their strength, their temperament?
The horses we have now are Russian trotters. This is the breed that you see at Russian national championships. You can put Russian trotters, Arlov trotters, or other breeds in a troika. As long as the middle horse is capable of sustaining a fast trot over a long distance.
And how do you train your horses to pull a troika? And do you understand straight away who's going to be in the middle?
These horses were born here. I broke them all myself. We usually break horses around the age of one. We start by making them pull light sleds, train them and observe. By the time they're 2 years old, we can see which ones are capable of sustaining a steady, fast trot. We like to pick bigger horses to run in the middle so that the troika looks nice.
And it's because you've raised them from such an early age that you've reached this deep bond with your horses.
Yes, we've raised these horses since they were little. The troika must be a unit, three horses and three men, the rider and his assistants. When they all work towards the same goal, the results will come.
And do the horses always work in the same team, or can you mix them up?
It all depends on the character and the nervous system. Stallions sometimes fight each other. It's complicated. You need to observe them, study their behavior, keep training them, etc. Work is key.
Well, I can see that this horse is keen to get going. I won't get in your way anymore. Maybe we can add the other horses to the troika. So it's considered that the troika is capable of overcoming difficult weather conditions, complicated terrain. How does it do that?
The troika was created to travel long distances, after all. Its purpose was to ride fast and far. So they just manage, each horse pulling its share. We're riding a sports troika that's used to smooth tracks. But troikas can negotiate rough terrain as well.
And to what extent do you control the horses now, and to what extent do they understand the task at hand?
The horses in this troika work well as a team. They understand each other by now, and I just supervise. But they can sometimes act up too. The power of three horses is quite a lot.
I can tell, they're really moving us. The Russian troika might be added to the UNESCO list of intangible heritage. So it's not just a mode of transport, it's a cultural icon. Why is it so deeply ingrained in Russian culture?
For starters, the troika looks great. It's beautiful, it's fast, and it's also part of our history. The Arlov breed will soon celebrate its 250th anniversary. The troika started with this breed. So it's about history, yes, and national pride.
Well, talking about history, the troika is often mentioned in Russian folklore and tales. Can you share some with us?
I can't tell you off the top of my head right now, especially while driving. But you're right, of course. Tales are rooted in history. They're based on what really happened. One doesn't cancel the other. Tales and history only enrich one another.
Well, Alexei, thank you very much for giving me an unforgettable experience and the chance to ride on a Russian troika.
You're very welcome. We're going slowly right now, and the troika looks beautiful, like a painting. But when you're going at full speed, you'd have snow in winter or dirt in summer flying from under their hooves. It's quite something.
I think it's very nice.
Let me show you what a troika is truly capable of.
Okay, let's do it. Oh God, we're really moving now. The snow's in our faces.
Yes, the snow is in our faces.
And that's what this is for protecting us.
Yes, this is for protection against the snow. They're really pulling, eager to do a good job, eager to run. It's not easy to hold the reins.
Is it physically demanding?
Yes, it is.